This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Hell's Princess, The Mystery of Belganess, Butcher of Men, by Harold Schechter, performed by Malcolm Hillgartner.
For Christoph Keller. Belganess was a lady fair in Indiana State. She weighed about 300 pounds, and that is quite some weight. That she was stronger than a man her neighbors all did own. She butchered hogs right easily, and did it all alone. But hogs were just a sideline she indulged in now and then. Her favorite occupation was a butchering of men. Anonymous, The Ballad of Belganess. Prologue. Bluebeard's Door. Fairyland, as every child knows, is a terrifying place, populated by all manner of nightmarish beings, the snaggle-toothed witch who lusts for the fattened flesh of little children, the bloodthirsty giant ready to roast any trespassing human on a spit, the smooth-talking wolf with a sweet tooth for tasty young girls. Of all the scary stories told about that realm of dark enchantment, however, none more closely resembles a modern-day horror movie than the tale of Bluebeard. Though scholars have identified variants of this folktale in societies throughout the world, the version best known in our own culture was originally put into writing by French author Charles Perrault in his 1697 classic Mother Goose Tales, Conte de ma mère Loire. Supposedly modeled on the infamous 15th-century sadist Gilles de Rais, Joan of Arc's one-time field marshal, accused of the torture murder of countless peasant children, Perrault's Bluebeard is a high-born serial wife-slayer whose creepy castle contains a locked secret chamber in which he stores the dismembered body parts of his fatally curious brides. To test her obedience, each new wife is left alone with a complete set of keys and a warning not to enter the mysterious room. In every case but one, however, the temptation proves too strong. No sooner has her husband gone than she runs down to the forbidden chamber and, with trembling hand, unlocks the door. Ouvrez en tremblant la porte, as Perrault writes. Not many years before Perrault set down his harrowing tale of the grisly horrors hidden behind Bluebeard's door, one of his countrymen, the famed explorer René Robert Cavalier de La Salle, undertook an expedition around the Great Lakes. While passing through a stretch of present-day Indiana, then part of the Potawatomi Nation, he and his men followed an old Indian trail that cut through a dense hardwood forest before opening onto a rolling, tall grass prairie. To La Salle and the early French fur traders who came after him, this opening became known as the door, la porte, in their language. For the next century and a half, the area remained devoid of white inhabitants. In all the West, prolific in beauty, there was not a lovelier region, writes an early historian, but it was in the sole possession of the red man, who roamed at will over the prairies and encamped in the groves, living on the game and fish which were abundant on the land and in the sparkling lakes. It wasn't until 1829 that the first white pioneers appeared, a widow named Miriam Benedict, her 7 grown children, and a son-in-law, Henley Clyburn. By the beginning of 1832, more than 100 other families had settled in the territory. In April of that year, the county of La Porte, consisting of 462 square miles, was officially incorporated by an act of the state legislature. After casting his vote, one crusty old lawmaker demanded to know the meaning of the new county's outlandish name. Informed that it was French for the door, he indignantly proposed that the high-flown foreign word be replaced with something more suitably American. Happily, observes one chronicler, his advice was not followed, and the county received the beautiful name La Porte instead of being forever known to the world as Gateville or Dorburg. Seeking a site to establish a county seat, a few enterprising settlers acquired a particularly choice tract of land, 450 acres in size, and adorned with a chain of small lakes, gem-like in their dazzling beauty. A courthouse and jail were promptly erected, and a government land office opened. Within a few years, the new county seat, also named LaPorte, had grown from a tiny village of scattered log buildings into a flourishing town with all the departments of human life which go to making a thriving community. Churches and schools, taverns and hotels, merchants and mechanics, doctors and lawyers, as well as two newspapers, one promoting the Whig Party, one the Democratic. In 1852, the town of LaPorte was upgraded to a city. By then, its population had grown to roughly 5,000. The following decades witnessed the construction of a waterworks plant, the installation of street lighting, the introduction of a telephone system, and successive waves of other civic improvements. Roads were paved, cement sidewalks laid down, dozens of old wooden buildings demolished, and handsome brick ones erected in their places. Besides several large drugstores and dry goods emporiums, LaPorte's places of business included 25 grocery stores, 6 flour and feed stores, 6 furniture dealers, 4 bakeries, 10 butcher shops, 4 hardware merchants, 6 boot and shoe firms, 26 tobacco shops, 4 sewing machine dealers, 9 milliners and dressmakers, 2 book and stationery stores, 9 boarding houses, 24 saloons, 6 billiard rooms, 6 barbers, 7 livery stables, 2 tanneries, and 3 undertakers. Its residential streets were lined with so many trees that it became known as the Maple City. Altogether, crowed one lifelong resident, the city of LaPorte, with her magnificent courthouse, excellent city hall, and splendid school buildings, her fine streets, her beautiful adjacent lakes, her spacious outlying country, and her excellent railroad facilities, was the fit capital of one of the best counties in the state. It wasn't only the physical attributes of the place that made the county and city of LaPorte so exceptional in the eyes of its boosters, but the caliber of its residents. LaPorteans have always taken pride in the achievements of their most distinguished fellow citizens. Among the notables celebrated in local histories were Jacob J. Mann, manufacturer of a harvesting machine that predated the famous McCormick Reaper, Dr. F. T. Wrench, creator of a collapsible sanitary toothbrush, Antipas J. Bowell, inventor of a dog-powered butter churn, Dr. S. B. Collins, discoverer of the Collins painless cure for opium eaters, and such local literati as Benjamin F. Taylor and Mrs. Clara J. Armstrong, authors, respectively, of the poetry volumes Old Time Pictures and Sheaves of Time and LaPorte in June. In later decades, LaPorte would be the home of other even more widely known figures, including Zerna Sharp, co-creator of the Dick and Jane books that taught reading to generations of American schoolchildren, Frederick C. Menon, inventor of Jiffy Pop popcorn, as well as a patented instrument for detecting gonorrhea, William Matthias Scholl, our nation's preeminent manufacturer of foot care products, singer Dorothy Clare, who performed with the Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey bands and starred in the 1948 Broadway smash Finian's Rainbow, and Brewster Martin Higley, lyricist of the American standard Home on the Range. Of course, even its most ardent champions had to concede that, along with these and other luminaries, LaPorte had produced its share of criminals. In early 1836, a resident of the county named Pelton was waylaid, murdered, and robbed of a considerable sum of money by an acquaintance named Staves, who was promptly apprehended, tried, and sent to the gallows. 2 years later, in February 1838, 19-year-old Joshua M. Copland, a native of LaPorte Township who had just returned home from Virginia, where he had collected a long overdue debt, was shot to death and robbed of the money, $600 in gold and silver coins, by his traveling companion, a young man named David Scott. Tracked down, jailed, and tried in LaPorte, Scott was hanged before an approving crowd a few months later. In December 1841, tavern keeper Charles Egbert, enraged against a rival named James Smith, who had opened a competing establishment that had taken all the trade away from Mr. Egbert's place of business, went to Smith's barroom armed with a newly purchased Dirk knife and stabbed the latter to death. Arrested and held on $5,000 bail, Egbert managed to come up with the money, then promptly fled to Texas, still a part of Mexico, where, according to later reports, he underwent a religious conversion and became a Methodist class leader. A most remarkable murder took place in 1862. Following the discovery of the newly slain corpse of a German émigré named Fred Miller, suspicion fell upon his wife. A group of Miller's male friends, intent on extorting a confession, strung the woman up by the neck from a tree limb until she gasped out the identity of the ostensible culprit, a man named John Poston, who, so she claimed, had murdered her husband in her presence and had promised to marry her if she would not denounce him. Though Poston was promptly arrested and brought to trial, his accuser's testimony, having been coerced through torture, was deemed to be invalid, and the presiding magistrate felt constrained to acquit him. 3 years later, another German farmer, John Lohm, while driving his wagon back home after a day of husking corn, encountered a pair of strangers, James Woods and William Fulton, who, having spent the afternoon in a local saloon, were in that condition when whiskey most inflames the blood and leads its victims to the most desperate ends. Some sort of altercation ensued, instigated by the two intoxicated men. When Lohm attempted to continue on his way, Woods drunkenly drew a revolver and discharged it, inflicting a mortal wound upon the unarmed farmer. Convicted of second-degree murder, Woods was sentenced to the term of his natural life in the state penitentiary, while Fulton, guilty of manslaughter, was given a term of 13 years. During the last weeks of 1902, the people of LaPorte County were lashed into a fury by a particularly heinous killing that occurred in the town of Westville. The victim was 16-year-old Wesley Reynolds, a trusted clerk at the Westville State Bank, who doubled as the watchman, sleeping in the institution at night with three revolvers within reach. At daybreak on the morning of Sunday, November 30th, Reynolds was startled awake when a beer keg came crashing through the rear window of the bank building. Leaping to his feet, a pistol in each hand, the young man confronted a pair of heavily armed robbers and opened fire. In the ensuing gun battle, Reynolds was struck 3 times, one bullet passing through his chin and lodging at the base of his brain, another entering his neck and exiting between his shoulder blades, the third striking him directly in the heart, killing him instantly. Fleeing the bank empty-handed, the two desperados, one badly wounded by the heroic youth, as he would be hailed in newspapers throughout the country, stole a horse in Surrey from a nearby barn and fled. Young Reynolds's funeral, held on December 3rd, was attended by the entire population of Westville, and a fund, overseen by State Senator Charles E. Harold, was immediately established to erect a monument in his honor. A large reward was also offered for the apprehension of his killers, but despite the involvement of Pinkerton detectives who were put on their trail, the culprits were never apprehended. 2 weeks after the people of Westville turned out to pay their last respects to the martyred young bank teller, the Fort Wayne Daily News ran a story on a sudden epidemic of crime that seemed to be reigning in LaPorte County. Besides the Reynolds murder, there had been the recent armed robbery of 2 local young men by Negro footpads, an attempt to administer poison to a LaPorte woman by means of arsenic, and the killing of Albert Bader of LaPorte by a train following his attempt to escape arrest by breaking into a lakeside boathouse. The immediate occasion of the news article, however, was the violent death of a local farmer that had occurred the previous day, and whose circumstances were so bizarre that the town official called to the scene instantly suspected foul play. In the end, the death was ruled a tragic accident. Another 6 years would pass before the official's initial impression was confirmed. The supposedly accidental death of the farmer, a Norwegian émigré named Peter Gunness, would be recognized as the sinister handiwork of one of the most monstrous killers in the history of the state, if not of the entire nation. Casting about for comparisons, newspaper articles would invoke not only Charles Perrault's fairy tale ogre Bluebeard, but his ostensible historical prototype, Gilles de Rais. Unlike those earlier figures, however, and adding to the horror of the case, this Midwestern serial murderer was a woman. Like Fall River, Massachusetts, and Plainfield, Wisconsin, the homes respectively of 2 of the country's criminal legends, Lizzie Borden and Ed Gein, LaPorte, Indiana would become a macabre tourist destination, forever identified not as the birthplace of such proud native sons as William Matthias Scholl and Brewster Martin Higley, but as the site of an unspeakable horror, the ghastly murder farm of Belle Sorensen Gunness, the Lady Bluebeard. Part 1. Bella. 1. Paul's daughter. Reduced to charred ruins by the great conflagration of 1871, Chicago roared back to life in the following years, a phoenix of limestone, granite, and brick reborn from the ashes. By the early 1880s, a decade after being laid waste by the disaster, it had resurrected itself as the gem of the prairies, the most American of America's cities, a vast, teeming, magnet metropolis, drawing hordes of eager young men and women in flight from their stultifying Midwestern small towns, villages, and farms. Along with these life-hungry seekers pouring in from the provinces, great tides of immigrants swept into the rebuilt city, Germans and Poles, Scots and Irish, Italians and Jews. By 1890, according to one eminent historian, close to 80% of the city's population was of foreign parentage, drawn from every civilized quarter of the globe. A significant percentage of those foreign-born newcomers hailed from Norway. Indeed, Norwegians were among the earliest settlers to the area, establishing a colony there when Chicago was nothing but a cluster of crude timber buildings planted on the swampy shores of Lake Michigan, a frontier mud hole where fetid muck oozed up from beneath the wood-planked sidewalks, and the unpaved streets were such quagmires that wagons would sink to their axles and remain stuck for days. In 1850, there were 562 Norwegians living in Chicago, making them the third largest immigrant group after the German and Irish. 10 years later, that number had increased threefold. By 1870, Norwegian-born Chicagoans numbered more than 8,000. Like their fellow Scandinavian immigrants, the Norwegians of Chicago were widely regarded as a frugal, industrious, and upstanding people who enhanced the moral character of the metropolis. "We get no better population," one early editorialist declared of them, "and we most cordially welcome them to the land of liberty, equality, and fraternity." Their native honesty and integrity were epitomized by the inspirational tale of little Knut Iverson, recounted by the turn-of-the-century historian A.T. Andreas. On the sweltering day of Tuesday, August 3, 1856, as Andreas tells it, 10-year-old Knut had gone down to the river to swim when he encountered a gang of teenaged ruffians who attempted to force him to sneak into the garden of a gentleman named Elston and steal fruit for the larger boys to eat. When Knut refused to do so, because of the consciousness in his own mind that to steal was wrong, the older boys drowned him in the river. Reported in the national press, the tragedy inspired the inimitable P.T. Barnum to contribute $200 toward the erection of a monument to the immortal child, an enduring memorial, so the showman proclaimed in his typically bombastic style, that would be for ages the Mecca to which pilgrims from every quarter of this great continent will gladly flock with their little ones, who may be thus fully impressed with the important and glorious principle so feelingly taught in the cruel death of this infantile martyr, that it is better to die than to steal. Norwegians could point with pride to other members of their ethnic community, men of enormous enterprise and ambition, who seemed the living validation of the American dream. One of the most prominent was Ivar Lawson, who rose from day laborer to millionaire by investing every penny of his hard-won savings into vacant city lots, enjoyed a sterling political career as city council member and state legislator, and, among his other contributions to his countrymen, helped organize the First Norwegian Evangelical Lutheran Church and the Scandinavian Emigrant Aid Society. Another local icon of self-made success was Christian Jevne. Immigrating to the United States as a 25-year-old, the determined young man clerked in a grocery store by day while attending night school to improve his English and study bookkeeping. With $200 in savings that he painstakingly accumulated, he eventually opened his own business, which he ultimately built into the largest wholesale and retail grocery concern in Chicago, importing coffee direct from Sumatra and Arabia, tea from China and Ceylon, wine from Europe, cheese, fish, canned goods, and aquavit from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And then there was John Anderson, who arrived in Chicago at the age of 9 and worked his way up from newspaper delivery boy to co-founder, with Ivar Lawson, of Skandinaven, the most widely read and influential Norwegian-language newspaper in the country, a journal so vital to America's Norwegian population that, for his services as publisher, Anderson would ultimately be knighted by King Oscar II. Even as they pursued their new lives in America, the members of Chicago's Norwegian community found frequent occasions to honor their ethnic heritage. They celebrated Norway's Independence Day each May 17th, threw a massive outdoor party on the millennium of Norway's unification under the Viking King Harald Fairhair, and turned out by the thousands in July 1875 for an open-air gala to commemorate the sailing of the sloop Restauration, the so-called Norwegian Mayflower, that carried the first boatload of immigrants from the coastal town of Stavanger to the United States 50 years earlier. One of the highlights of Chicago's Great World Columbian Exposition of 1893 was the arrival of the dragon-proud longship Viking, which, in emulation of Leif Erikson's epical voyage, had been sailed across the Atlantic by an intrepid crew under the command of Captain Magnus Andersen, a feat that stirred elated feelings of pride in the hearts of Norwegians throughout the United States. By the time of the World's Fair, Chicago's Norwegian population, which would eventually grow to be the third largest in the world after Oslo and Bergen, numbered slightly over 20,000. The wealthiest among them, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, and bankers, had turned the neighborhood of Wicker Park into such a tightly knit ethnic enclave that, among themselves, they referred to it as Homensbyen, after a fashionable residential district of Oslo. Their less affluent countrymen, the merchants, shop owners, skilled laborers, and craftsmen, congregated in the neighborhoods of Humboldt Park and Logan Square. As had been the case since the earliest days of their arrival, serious crime was strikingly rare in their community. Official reports issued by the Chicago Department of Police show that between 1880 and 1890, Norwegians accounted for a mere 1% of arrests in the city, generally for infractions no worse than drunken, disorderly conduct. This enviable record, as one historian writes, was shining proof of one of the most admirable traits of Chicago's Norwegian population, their deference to law and order. Among the more than 25,000 Norwegians who came to these shores in 1881, the start of a great wave of migration from Norway that would not subside until the decade's end, was a 22-year-old woman from Selbu on the country's west coast, not far from the city of Trondheim. Her most famous photograph shows a stout, grim-faced matron fixing the camera with a baleful glare, although to be fair, that picture was taken years later, when she had settled into a hard-bitten middle age. Even in her 20s, however, as an earlier photo attests, she was a notably unlovely young woman, with a large head, small eyes, short nose, and a wide, fat-lipped mouth that, when set in a frown, bore resemblance to a frog's. She was christened Brunhild Paulsdotter, Brunhild, daughter of Paul, to which was added, in accordance with custom, the name of the farm on which her family lived and worked, making her full Norwegian name Brunhild Paulsdotter Storset. Unsurprisingly, very little is known about her earliest years, apart from a few official documents laboriously dug up by later historians, confirmation records, census reports, and the like. Reliable facts about her background are virtually non-existent. Born on November 11, 1859, she grew up in Ingvia, one of several tiny hamlets within the district of Selbu. Her sharecropper father, Paul Pettersen Storset, a native of the area and one of its poorer members, leased an acre or so of the Storset farm, where he raised a few cows, sheep, and goats, and grew just enough crops, barley, oats, and potatoes, to keep his wife, Berit, and their seven children from starving. During the winter months, he supplemented his meager income by working as a stonemason. Even so, his situation was sometimes so dire that, on at least one occasion, he was compelled to apply for public welfare, receiving 10 kroners of poor relief from town coffers. Like other peasant children, Brunhild was expected to perform a variety of chores from an early age, milking, churning, drawing water, watching over the cattle to ensure that they did not wander off or, even worse, fall prey to the malicious hill spirits who shrink cows to the size of mice and drive them away to a mysterious subterranean realm. Because her family could not afford hardwood for its hearth fire, she was also sent out daily to connect snurkvist, the tiny, dried-up twigs of the spruce tree normally used for kindling. a task that earned her the demeaning nickname Snurkvistpala, roughly translated as Paul's Twig Daughter, among her less charitable neighbors. In June 1874, at the age of 14, she was confirmed at the Evangelical Lutheran Church. Her religious instructor, Pastor Augaton Hanstien, evaluated her as good in religious knowledge and diligence, a ranking that only one half of the girls obtained. That same year, she was hired out as a dairy maid to a neighbor named Rode, who would later describe her as a diligent human being that in all ways behaved well. After a full day of toiling the fields, she would often sit by the firelight, knitting mittens, caps, and other woolen goods adorned with the traditional star rose pattern for which Selbu was renowned. Diversion was provided by the family storyteller, who would regale the household with magical tales of clever country lads who win the hands of haughty princesses, giant trolls with an unquenchable hunger for human flesh and blood, and the siren-like creatures known as Huldr, sinister females with hollowed-out backs and long cow's tails who lure mortal men to their doom. Not all of Brunhild's neighbors shared her pastor's and employer's high opinions of her. Here in Selbu, the local newspaper, Selbigen editorialized, she is remembered by many as a very bad human being, capricious and extremely malicious. She had unpretty habits, always in the mood for dirty tricks, talked little, and was a liar already as a child. As a grown-up, she was still little respected, and was a scum of society. Stories would also circulate that, at 17, she was impregnated by the son of a wealthy landowner who, having no intention of marrying her, lured her to a lonely spot and beat her so severely that she miscarried. According to this account, her assailant died soon afterward of an intestinal ailment whose symptoms were suspiciously like those of arsenic poisoning. There are good reasons, however, to doubt the truth of this anecdote, for which no documentation exists. Her neighbors' exceptionally harsh judgments of her character are likewise open to question, since they were offered many years after her departure from Norway, and were almost certainly colored by subsequent events. By the time the Selbigen editorial appeared, the young dairymaid from Selbu had metamorphosed into a creature as evil as any mythical Huldr, a woman, as one historian puts it, whose malevolence seemed to match that of the unseen beings peopling Norwegian folk tradition. 2. Coming to America. The Norwegian immigrants who made the exodus to the New World in the latter decades of the 19th century left copious accounts of their arduous journey. It began for many of them, as it did for Brunhild Paulsdottir Storset, with a voyage from Trondheim to the English port city of Hull aboard the steamship Tasso. During the four-day crossing of the North Sea, the bulk of the travelers remained below decks in steerage, huddling in groups or stretched out fully clothed on the narrow wooden shelves that served as bunks. Even in good weather, the ship tended to roll about on the waves, and, as various letters and journal entries attest, seasickness was so common that even passengers accustomed to sailing were often made ill by the pervasive stench of vomit. For those who could hold down their food, three daily meals were offered. Though promotional brochures describe the menu in glowing terms, the testimony of one passenger tells a very different story. For breakfast, there was always sweet tea without milk and dry hard biscuits, and the same for supper. There was butter, but it was so rancid that we could not digest it. For dinner, soup with meat, but there was no taste to the soup, and the meat was as salty as herring. One day we had salted fish with a dash of soup, but it was inedible for most of us, and we just ended up dumping our portions into the sea. The privies, located on the upper deck, were particularly vile. Small, cramped, dark spaces without water, as one observer wrote, those for men and women being close together, the entrance in no way protected from the weather. Altogether more evil-smelling, unsatisfactory places, it is difficult to imagine. Upon their arrival in Hull, the emigrants were herded to various dockside lodging houses and given a simple meal of soup, coffee, and bread and butter while their baggage was being unloaded. They were then hurried to the station of the North Eastern Railway Company for the train ride to Liverpool, where they would board a steamer to America. For the vast bulk of emigrants who traveled in steerage, the transatlantic crossing had improved considerably by the late 1800s. Advertisements for the new steamers touted the between-deck living area as high, light, and spacey, with different compartments for families, for unmarried males, and for unmarried females, and with a crew specially employed to maintain order and cleanliness. The food was fresh and rich, made of first-class supplies, and served to the passengers by stewards. The reality proved somewhat different. The meals were often barely palatable. One traveler recalled an offering of pork that, from its appearance, had made the trip across the Atlantic before. The toilet facilities were execrable. The decks, despite the supposed attentions of the special cleaning crew, were a vile mess from the constant wholesale seasickness. Even so, the sheer reduction in travel time made the trip a far more tolerable experience than it had been in the past. Whereas the sailing vessels of an earlier era, brigs, schooners, sloops, barks, clippers, might take up to 65 days to make the voyage, modern passenger ships like the Thingvalla, Hekla, and Geysir could complete the journey in as little as 10. Most of the steamers docked in Quebec, New York, or Boston. From there, the new arrivals from Norway would make their way by boat, rail, and wagon to their final destinations: Minnesota, Illinois, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Washington State. Most settled in small farm communities, though others chose ethnic enclaves in cities like Minneapolis and Seattle, and in the case of Brunhild Paulsdotter Storschut, Chicago. Several years earlier, Brunhild's older sister, Olina, her senior by 10 years, had moved to the United States and settled in Chicago, where she met and married a man named John R. Larson. It was Nellie, as she now called herself, who had invited Brunhild to come live with her and her husband, and who had paid her sister's passage to the New World. Shortly after arriving in Chicago and moving in with the Larsons, Brunhild, like Nellie and countless other immigrants, adopted a new American name, Bella Peterson. At the time Bella embarked on her new life, most unmarried Scandinavian women seeking employment in Chicago chose domestic occupations over factory work. According to one eminent historian, in 1880, about three-quarters of Norwegian-born women working outside the home became servants, housekeepers, or laundresses. Bella Peterson did likewise, taking in laundry, doing piecework sewing, and cleaning homes for meager wages that she handed over to the Larsons for her upkeep. This type of labor was nothing new to the former farm maid, who had spent her hard-scrabble girlhood performing precisely such menial tasks. But she hadn't come to America to slave her life away in drudge work. There were riches to be had here, and, as any stroll through the commercial heart of Gilded Age Chicago made tantalizingly clear, a world of glittering merchandise for sale. In his classic novel Sister Carrie, set in the late 1880s, Theodore Dreiser offers a portrait of another provincial young woman, newly arrived in Chicago, whose most covetous longings are aroused as she wanders for the first time through one of the city's great palaces of consumption, a downtown department store. Carrie passed along the busy aisles, much affected by the remarkable display of trinkets, dress goods, stationery, and jewelry. Each separate counter was a showplace of dazzling interest and attraction. She could not help feeling the claim of each trinket and valuable upon her personally, and yet she did not stop. There was nothing there which she could not have used, nothing which she did not long to own. The dainty slippers and stockings, the delicately frilled skirts and petticoats, the laces, hair ribbons, hair combs, purses, all touched her with individual desire, and she felt keenly the fact that not any of these things were in the range of her purchase. The material desires aflame in Carrie Meaver's breast burned even more fiercely in Bella Peterson's. The deprivations of her youth had left her with a lust for wealth. "My sister was insane on the subject of money," Nellie Larson would later remark. "She would do anything to get it." As for marriage, Bella made no secret of what she wanted in a mate. She never seemed to care for a man for his own self, only for the money or luxury he was able to give her, Nellie observed. Years afterward, Bella would say of her first husband, the father of her children, and by all accounts a kind and loving man, that she had stayed with him only because he provided her with a nice house. His name was Mats Ditlow Anton Sorensen. The only extant photograph of him shows a powerfully built, bull-necked fellow with strong Nordic features, a handlebar mustache of the kind fashionable in those days, and a high balding dome. 5 years older than Bella, he was one of the 800 employees of the Mandel Brothers department store on State and Madison Streets, where he worked as the night watchman. They were married in March 1884 at the Evangelical Lutheran Bethania Church on Grand Avenue and Carpenter Street. Officiating at the ceremony was the Reverend John Z. Torgerson, a venerable figure among his fellow Norwegians who, at the time of his death in 1905, would be eulogized as Cupid's noted aide, having performed over 15,000 weddings in the course of his 36-year ministry, more than any other clergyman in the country. In her wedding photograph, the 24-year-old Bella poses proudly in a formal black dress, perhaps taffeta or silk moire, with lace ruffles and a triple strand of pearls around her neck, her left hand crossed over her right, so as to display her double wedding bands. The historical record of the Sorensens' life is a virtual blank for the first decade of their marriage. Still, it is possible to draw some inferences from the few documented facts. By most accounts, Bella seemed possessed of powerfully maternal impulses. She had great love for children, her sister Nellie recalled. Almost every Norwegian Sunday school child in Chicago knew her for her kindness. She appeared especially touched by the plight of the orphaned or abandoned. Attending the children's picnics at Humboldt Park, she would get out on the platform and offer to take care of children who needed a home. Indeed, it was her eagerness to raise a child that led to a bitter break with her sister. Unable to conceive during the early years of her marriage, Bella directed much of her maternal feeling toward her 4-year-old niece, Olga, the youngest of Nellie's 5 children. "She was an awfully cute little girl," Nellie later explained, "and my sister demanded to have her to rear." Though Olga was permitted to stay with her aunt for an extended visit of 6 weeks, Nellie, quite understandably, refused to let Mrs. Sorensen adopt my little daughter, and from that day, my sister would hardly speak to me. In 1891, Bella Sorensen realized her dream of taking in a child, an infant girl named Jenny. Living close to the Sorensens at the time was a couple named Olsen, who became close friends with Bella and Mats. As Anton Olsen, the child's father, later explained, "When Jenny was 8 months old, her mother was dying. Mrs. Sorensen begged the dying woman to bequeath the child to her. My wife put the baby in Bella's arms and called on her to swear that she would guard the little one as her own, rear and care for her. Bella swore that she would regard the pledge as sacred. My wife died soon afterward. After Bella took the child, I saw her frequently. She brought Jenny to me often and kept her well dressed. The child was happy." Years later, after he had remarried, Olsen tried to regain custody of his daughter. Bella fought him in court and won. Though Mats never brought home more than $15 in weekly wages, equivalent to roughly $450 today, he and Bella somehow managed to acquire enough money by 1894 to purchase a small candy store at Grand Avenue and Edward Street. Occupying the street-level floor of a 2-story wood-frame building, the store, as a newspaper photograph makes clear, sold tobacco and cigars, newspapers and magazines, stationery, and some grocery staples, along with the popular confections of the time. Despite its location in a busy commercial district, however, the shop failed to prosper, and Bella watched with growing consternation as her cherished money drained away. Less than a year after she and Mats bought the place, a fire broke out in the store. At the time, no one was present except Bella and her foster daughter Jenny, then a 3-year-old toddler. "The first known of the fire," reported the Chicago Tribune, "was when Mrs. Sorensen with her child came running out onto the sidewalk, crying, 'Fire!' at the top of her voice." By the time the blaze was extinguished, the interior of the store had been completely destroyed. Though Bella claimed that a small kerosene lamp had exploded, insurance investigators, sifting through the debris, could find no trace of glass fragments or other evidence of a broken lamp. Despite suspicions of arson, the insurance company ultimately paid up. Soon afterward, the Sorensons divested themselves of the store, selling it to the brother of its original owner. Having recouped their investment, Bella and Mats moved out to the blue-collar fringe of the well-to-do suburb of Austin, where they purchased a three-story, bay-windowed house on Alma Street. Over the next 2 years, between 1896 and 1898, they became the parents of four more children, Caroline, Myrtle, Axel, and Lucy. Whether these were babies born in rapid succession to Bella, then in her late 30s, or, as seems more probable, orphaned or unwanted infants that she took in, perhaps according to later accounts, for a monetary consideration, remains even today a matter of dispute. One fact is certain. Soon after their births, two of them died. Caroline at 5 months old, Axel at 3 months. At a time when the U.S. infant mortality rate was shockingly high, approximately 100 deaths per 1,000 live births, no suspicions were aroused by the sudden passing of the little ones, whose causes of death were given respectively as enterocolitis, acute inflammation of the bowels, and hydrocephalus, commonly called water in the brain. Mats, who had found work with the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad, was bringing home wages of $12 a week when a seemingly golden opportunity came his way. On the evening of Friday, October 1, 1897, the Sorensons were visited at home by a gentleman named Angus Ralston, who presented himself as the agent and chief engineer for an enterprise known as the Yukon Mining and Trading Company. Ralston explained that Yukon Mining was a corporation of great financial resources that had been incorporated with a capital stock of $3,500,000, owned mines in New Mexico, and had great and extensive interests in Alaska and the Klondike regions. The company was presently hiring miners, willing to endure the rigors of a year-long stretch in the Alaskan wilderness for the chance to strike it rich. At Bella's urging, Mats quickly signed on, entering into a formal agreement with the company that was signed, sealed, and witnessed on October 27th. According to its terms, Mats agreed to go to Alaska in the employ of the company and prospect for gold, locate same, and do any other kind of work that the manager in charge of the expedition requires done for 1 year, beginning April 1, 1898. In return, he would not only be paid the same wages as other men in the camps where the mines are located, but also receive 1/4 interest on all mines located by him, along with 2,800 shares of stock in the corporation. Since the Sorensen family would be without their breadwinner for a full year, the company also agreed to pay Bella Sorensen, his wife, $35 each month while he is in their employ, and to charge same to his account for salary. Bella, who, as her sister observed, cared little for Mats as a person, was happy to send him off for a year to prospect for gold. Blinded by the promise of dazzling wealth, she and Mats also agreed to invest a considerable sum of their own money to cover his supplies for 1 year. On the same day that Mats entered into his agreement with the company, he and Bella signed over a joint promissory note for $700, equivalent to over $20,000 today, putting up the deed to their Alma Street property as collateral security. What happened next is detailed in a lawsuit Bella and Mats subsequently launched against the Yukon Mining and Trading Company. In compliance with said contract, reads the document, Mats made all preparations and at great sacrifice and expense to himself to go to Alaska, and presented himself to said corporation on or about the first day of April 1898, and informed the officers of said corporation that he was then ready to fulfill his contract and would hold himself in readiness to go to Alaska. When 2 months passed, with no word from any representative of the company, he and Bella, their suspicions aroused, contacted a lawyer who demanded the right to examine the books of said corporation. His investigation confirmed the Sorensons' worst fears. Far from the booming gold mining operation it purported to be, the Yukon Mining and Trading Company had absolutely no financial resources. According to the bill in chancery filed by Bella and Mats in June 1898, said corporation had not and has not any interest of any value in any mines in New Mexico, Alaska, or elsewhere. It is absolutely without means, and it has given away large blocks of stock, to wit, 525,000 shares, Its officers and promoters are men without means and men who are not financially responsible. It was formed for the sole purpose of defrauding innocent investors and never at any time intended to fulfill its contract. It is now entirely defunct, insolvent, and abeyant, with no assets or means to pay its legitimate debts or to continue in business. Like others whose greed gets the better of their judgment, Bella and Mads had fallen victim to a scam. Their promissory note, along with the accompanying trust deed on their property, had been sold to a real estate salesman and mortgage broker named Emmanuel Hogensen for $500. When that note came due in 2 years, the Sorensons would be required to pay him $700 plus interest, or risk losing their home. Though the Sorensons ultimately prevailed in their lawsuit, preventing Hogensen from cashing in on their note, their get-rich-quick dream had come to a mortifying end. Mads returned to his earlier job as night watchman at the Mandel Brothers department store, while Bella seemed destined to spend the rest of her days as the wife of a low-earning working man. But, as events would soon prove, she had other plans. On the evening of Tuesday, April 10, 1900, a fire, reportedly caused by a defective heating apparatus, broke out in the Sorensen's Alma Street home. Though firefighters arrived in time to save the building, Bella and Mads suffered the loss of roughly $650 worth of household goods. Fortunately, as the Chicago Tribune reported, all the property destroyed was insured, and the couple received another hefty settlement. For Bella, there was still more to come. At the time of the fire, Mads belonged to a mutual benefits association that provided him with a $2,000 life insurance policy, set to expire on Monday, July 30th, 1900. He had decided to let that policy lapse and take out a new one for $3,000 that would become operative on the same day. That very Monday afternoon, Dr. J.C. Miller, a young physician who had once boarded with the Sorensons, received an urgent summons from Bella. Hurrying to the Alma Street address, he found Mads, fully clothed, lying dead atop his bed. By then, another doctor, Charles E. Jones, the Sorensons' family physician, had arrived. Questioning Bella, they learned that her husband, who was suffering from a bad cold, had come home from work that morning complaining of a fearful headache. She had given him a dose of quinine powder, then gone down to the kitchen to prepare dinner for the children. When she went back upstairs a short while later to check on her husband, she had found him dead. Thinking, as he later explained, that the druggist had made a mistake and given her morphine instead of quinine, Miller asked to see the paper in which the powder had been wrapped. Bella replied that she had thrown it away. With no other evidence to go on beyond the symptoms as Bella described them, the two doctors concluded that Mads had died of a cerebral hemorrhage. For Bella, the sole beneficiary of her husband's two life insurance policies, the timing of his sudden death could not have been more fortuitous. Had Sorensen died a day earlier, one newspaper later explained, his wife would have been able to collect only on the first policy for $2,000, or, if a day later, only on the second for $3,000. Dying as he did, she collected on both the old and new policies a total of $5,000. Translated into today's dollars, the widow Sorensen was richer by $150,000. 3 days later, on the morning of Thursday, August 2, 1900, Mats Ditlo Anton Sorensen was laid to rest beside his two infant children at the Forest Home Cemetery. Among those attending the funeral was Bella's estranged sister, Nellie. Exactly what transpired between them is unknown, though, according to Nellie's testimony, she was gripped at one point with a dark premonition. "While I was there," she would later recount, "a terrible feeling came over me. I felt just like something was going to happen." The sensation hit her with such force that she grew dizzy and could not stand up. Another 8 years would pass before she understood the meaning of the dread that seized her that day. 3. The Grinder. Situated on McClung Road on the outskirts of LaPorte, the property known locally as Matty Altick's Place had a checkered history. The original owner of the land was John C. Walker, one of LaPorte's founding fathers, who, in 1846, erected an imposing house for his daughter Harriet and her husband John W. Holcomb. Nearly 20 years later, in 1864, the Holcombs, whose Southern sympathies made them pariahs in a county that sent more than 2,500 men to fight for the Union cause, left LaPorte for good. Not long after they absconded, the house was reportedly sold to one B.R. Carr, a local coal and lumber merchant whose son, G. Hyle Carr, became the leader of an outlaw band that terrorized that section of Indiana. When things got too hot for the gang, the younger Carr headed west to Denver, where he was eventually shot to death during an attempted bank holdup. Soon after his son's body was shipped back home, the elder Carr sold the place and disappeared from LaPorte, leaving behind a bundle of unpaid debts. In the following years, the house passed through the hands of several more reputedly ill-fated owners, including two brothers who died so suddenly that the coroner was called in to investigate, a farmer who hanged himself in an upstairs bedroom, and, in 1892, the individual who would briefly hold the title of the most notorious woman in northern Indiana, Mattie Altick. A transplanted big city madam, the flamboyant Mattie, a statuesque woman in the Gibson girl mold who sported a hat with an enormous ostrich plume when she went shopping downtown, transformed the place into the region's classiest whorehouse, complete with a marble-topped bar in the front entertaining room, a fancy carriage house, and a flashy fringe-topped surrey used to pick up her clients when they arrived by train from Chicago. When she died suddenly a few years later, the cause was officially given as heart disease, though stories persisted that she had either taken her own life after being jilted by a lover, or been poisoned by her sister, a rival brothel keeper named Eva Rupert, who ran a competing resort, as the newspapers euphemistically described it, in South Bend. Despite its sordid reputation, the Altick place had no trouble attracting buyers. In the 8 years after it ceased to operate as a bordello, it would have a succession of owners before being purchased by the woman whose infamy would so vastly surpass that of its earlier proprietress that, by comparison, Mattie Altick would seem as respectable as a Midwestern schoolmarm. Exactly how Bella Sorensen learned that the Altick place was for sale is unclear. Following the death of her husband, she paid a visit to a relative on a farm in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, and the idea of resettling on a farmstead of her own seems to have taken hold of her then. Back in Chicago, according to certain historians of the case, she placed a classified advertisement in the Tribune, seeking a suitable property. The ad caught the eye of the then-current owner of the Altick place, who contacted Bella. An agreement was struck, and in November 1901, after selling her Alma Street property, Bella Sorensen and her three children, Jenny, Myrtle, and Lucy, moved to LaPorte. The people of her new community would know her by a different name. Though she continued to sign herself Bella in her private correspondence, she adopted the plainer, more typically American Belle in her dealings with her neighbors. And within a few months of her arrival in LaPorte, her last name was no longer Sorensen. During their first decade of marriage, Belle and Mads had briefly taken in a boarder named Peter Ganess. Surviving photographs of Peter confirm one writer's description of him as a fine-looking blonde Viking of a man with clear blue eyes and a pointed yellow beard and mustache. An emigrant from Oslo who arrived in this country in 1885, he joined his brother, Gust, in Minneapolis before moving to Chicago in 1893, the year of the Great World's Fair, where he rented a room from the Sorensens while working in the stockyards. After a brief visit back to Norway, he returned to Minneapolis, where in June 1895, he married a young woman named Jenny Sophia Simpson. They lived in a house on Hennepin Street, while Peter worked as an order man for a grocery house. Their first child, a girl they christened Swanhild, was born in 1897. 4 years later, Jenny Ganess died while giving birth to their second child, another girl. During her visit to her cousin in Minnesota following Mats's death, the widow Sorensen made it her business to take a trip to Minneapolis and become reacquainted with her handsome and suddenly available former boarder. The years had not been kind to Belle. Hardly a beauty to begin with, she had aged into a coarse and mannish figure, described, in the particularly harsh words of one of her contemporaries, as a fat, heavy-featured woman with a big head covered with a mop of mud-colored hair, small eyes, huge hands and arms, and a gross body supported by feet grotesquely small. That she had so little trouble attracting men, even one as handsome as Peter Ganess, says much about the seductive appeal of her 48-acre Indiana farmstead. On April 1, 1902, the physically incongruous couple were married in the First Baptist Church of LaPorte, the Reverend George C. Moore officiating. 5 days after the nuptials, Peter's 7-month-old daughter died. Edema of the lungs was given as the official cause of death. Her body was shipped to Chicago, where it was interred in the Forest Home Cemetery beside the remains of the two other infants who had died in Bell's care. 8 months later, at around 3 a.m. on Tuesday, December 16th, Swan Nicholson and his family, the Ganesses' nearest neighbors, were startled awake by a sharp banging on the front door as though someone were striking it with an iron rod. Hurrying downstairs in their bedclothes, they found Bell's foster daughter Jenny standing on their porch, a stove poker clutched in one hand. "Mama wants you to come up," said the 12-year-old girl. "Papa's burned himself." When they arrived at the Gunness farmhouse a few minutes later, Swan and his young son Albert found Bell seated in the kitchen, so overwrought that she could barely speak coherently. Her husband, dressed in his long white nightshirt, was sprawled face down in the parlor, laying on his nose and blood on the floor, as Nicholson later testified. Squatting by the body, Nicholson took hold of his arms to feel the pulse and tried to talk to him, "but he wouldn't give me no answer." Ordered to go fetch a physician, young Albert ran all the way into town and aroused Dr. Beau Bowell, then serving as the county coroner. While the doctor got dressed, Albert hurried over to the barn where Bowell stabled his rig. Then the two quickly drove to the Ganess place. Striding into the parlor, Bowell got to his knees and made a close examination of the body, while the others, Swan, Albert, Jenny, and a sobbing Bell, stood around in a circle. Bowell could tell at once that Ganess had been dead for some time. The body was already growing rigid. The back of his head bore an ugly wound, thickly caked with blood, and his nose was broken and bent to one side. Bowell's immediate impression was that the man had been murdered. Bell, whose condition bordered on hysteria, was led back into the kitchen and seated in a chair. Bowell did his best to find out what had happened, though the story he managed to extract from the inconsolable woman raised more questions than it answered. From what he could gather, her husband had gone into the kitchen to get his shoes, which he kept near the stove to stay warm. As he stooped to retrieve them, a meat grinder had tumbled from a shelf above his head, striking the back of his skull, and overturning a bowl of hot brine that scalded his neck. Despite his injuries, he'd assured her that he was all right and had laid down to rest. A few hours later, she'd discovered him dead on the parlor floor. Though Bowell found this story highly suspect, he decided to reserve judgment until a post-mortem could be performed the next day. Young Albert Nicholson, however, harbored no such doubts. As he and his father headed back home, he remarked that he thought Mr. Ganess had been murdered. His father cautioned him not to say anything of the sort, or there might be trouble for Mrs. Ganess. Reporting on Peter Ganess's death the following day, the newspapers exhibited little of the caution that Swan Nicholson had urged on his son. "Crime of high degree," blared a headline in the Fort Wayne Daily News. During the past few weeks, or so the paper declared, murder had been running rampant in LaPorte County. Residents were still mourning the death of the heroic young Wesley Reynolds, killed in a shootout with two would-be bank robbers. The three Negro footpads who had murdered grocer John Koontzman remained at large, despite a $500 reward offered for their capture by the local Retail Merchants Association. Police were attempting to track down the person who had sent a box of arsenic-laced bonbons to young servant girl Matilda Baker, who, unsuspecting the poison in the candy, partook freely of it. And the mother of 17-year-old George Shearer barely escaped death when the youth suddenly became demented and tried to kill her with a carving knife. This string of tragedies had culminated with the sudden death of Peter Ganess in a mysterious manner that gave strong indications of foul play. On the afternoon of December 16th, Dr. Bowell, assisted by another local physician, Dr. H. H. Martin, conducted a postmortem on Ganesh's body. As detailed in his official report, Bowell found no evidence of scalds or burns on the entire body. Ganesh's nose was lacerated and broken.